Welcome. You're listening to Amped Up, the AMPO podcast. I'm Ellen Zaviska, Transportation Planning Manager with AMPO, which is the Association of Metropolitan Planning Organizations.
For this episode, I'm speaking with Tony Jordan, president of the Parking Reform Network. The Parking Reform Network educates the public about the impact of parking policy on climate change, equity, housing, and traffic. They seek to accelerate the adoption of parking reforms through research, coalition building, and direct advocacy. You might be asking, what do parking policies have to do with the work that MPOs do? In which case, I promise you we'll get to that. Because as always, this podcast is focused on the work that MPOs do across the country. First, I'm going to say welcome, Tony. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
It would be great if we could start with you telling us just a little bit about yourself, about what you do with Parking Reform Network, how you came to this job.
Yeah, thanks. I live in Portland. I've got some kids. I haven't had a car since they were very small. I grew up in Los Angeles in San Pedro, and I came about this kind of strangely. I have a politics degree, and I worked as a union organizer and a software developer until I read Shook's book in 2010, kind of randomly came across it. And in the years following that, I got involved in local advocacy in Portland, starting with parking. There were apartments being built with no parking on a street. The policy had been put in place about 10 years before, and then it took 10 years for the apartments to start getting built, and neighbors got upset and convinced the city to actually reimpose some parking requirements on that street, or citywide, actually, on the corridors. And so I had met some folks and thought, hey, I think that this, like, the theory is very sound, but what's missing is organizing activity around this, is getting people, regular people, to understand, non-professionals, to understand why parking is important to their cause or their issue. And so I started a local group called Portlanders for Parking Reform. And then I got involved with our YIMBY groups, Portland for Everyone and Portland Neighbors Welcome. And then as we started wrapping up some of the bigger work here in Portland, I wanted to help other people replicate our success. And also just, I felt like there was a need for a network of people who were interested in parking reform. So when people learned about it, increasingly it was becoming more well known. They had a place to land and connect with people. And also to really make sure that we're not just over-focusing on specific pieces, right? The parking reform kind of trifecta is get rid of your parking mandates, manage your curbs, and reinvest that money locally, ideally to reduce car dependency. But commercial mandates are still terrible. And the on-street situation needs to be reformed as well still. So how do we holistically look at this and build a movement to do it? And that's what the Parking Reform Network is doing.
You mentioned Donald Shoup, who's considered the father, the grandfather of this parking reform movement. We're speaking the second week of February. Unfortunately, he passed away last week. And I see from your website that he was one of the founding advisors for the Parking Reform Network. Just for our listeners who may not be familiar with him, could you tell us more about Donald Shoup's work and how it informed your interest in this movement?
Absolutely. He was born in 1938, and by the late 70s, he had a degree, and his doctorate was, I think, in economics from Yale. He was teaching at UCLA, and you can read a bunch of, I mean, if you read an obituary or some tributes around him, he's a fascinating guy. But he looked into what was going on with parking and by the late 70s and realized that something was pretty wrong with how so much of cities were taken up by parking, and mostly it was free. And so after decades of work on research, he published this book in 2005, The High Cost of Free Parking. And that was being taught in schools. And that was the book I read that really influenced me. He was always open to replying to people who wrote to him and was very friendly and supportive. I think this is one of the reasons that he's got so many memorials and so many people impacted by his work, and was gracious to me. And as I did my organizing, he meet with me and mentor me and provide that amount of like legitimacy, endorsement, advice that we needed to be credible. And over the last several years, really has helped out, even referring speaking engagements, or when people wrote him for advice, he'd refer them to us. So I think he, and it's not just me. I know that there are many people who were even his students. He has long-term relationships with many of his students. So I think it's really his boundless kind of energy for working on this specific issue was led him to work with so many people. We wouldn't be having this conversation absolutely if he hadn't worked on this for most of his life.
And you mentioned his seminal work, The High Cost of Free Parking. And I'm going to suggest to anyone who's hearing this who hasn't read it to check it out, because it will really open your eyes to the impact of parking on our entire transportation system and how it is such a factor in encouraging driving, where when we price parking, it might make people consider other modes of transportation. This topic, actually, for the AMPO podcast, was suggested by one of our interest groups. We have an interest group that's focused on active transportation. And again, folks might not always get that connection, but if you've ever walked across a huge sea of parking to get to a store, maybe from a transit stop or from the sidewalk, you have an understanding of how the requirements for huge parking lots and the location of huge parking lots can have an impact on people's transportation choices and the safety of people who are walking and stuff. What in your mind, Tony, are some of the key ways that parking policy affects how people get around, what we call their mode choice? What are the impacts of parking policy, and what are some of the key reforms that you guys are working on to improve specifically like active transportation?
Yeah, so many. I mean, the one core thing is just geography, right? The space that parking takes up is immense. And the more we add, the farther things are apart. So they're harder to get to. So that's a key. I think of it like there's three modes of how we get around, right? There's a lot of modes of how we get around, but three kind of strategies, main work. You get people from where they live to where they want to go, which is ostensibly not close to where they live. That's, you need transit, or they're going to drive their car, or they're going to ride a bike a long distance. You can move people closer. You can create more housing near where the places where people want to go, building more housing downtown or near activities. That's great. Mixed use development. And also you can, which is, I think, a lesser used strategy, is you can try to move activities that people do, like day-to-day errands and things, closer to where they live with infill commercial uses, smaller neighborhood commercial. In all these cases, parking impacts these things, right? When it's for the transit, I mean, parking adds cars to the road. If you build a parking garage, it's like a battery for traffic. This woman, Kathy Tuttle, who's here in Portland, said roads are just very long driveways, right? Any parking space you add, you need, it's not good by itself. Very few cars leave a parking space and just drive around and come back to that parking space. They almost always go somewhere else. And the more parking we're adding, we're just assuming that the network is going to need to accommodate more car traffic, and that's going to lead to congestion. I think that as far as like the, if you're trying to add housing into places where people are, you're trying to add other activities, if you have high parking mandates, it's either going to be not really convenient, as you mentioned, walking across parking lots or being farther apart from where the transit nodes are, or directly disrupting mobility, like curb cuts, right? And if you're requiring a bunch of parking, it breaks up that sidewalk. But it also can often make it impossible, prohibitively expensive, if not geometrically just impossible, to add housing or commercial uses where they are most effective. If you want to open a coffee shop in a neighborhood in Dallas, and you are opening it in an old house because that's a cool place to open a coffee shop, and the house happens to be 3,000 square feet, and the parking ratio is like one space for 100 square feet, you have to build 30 parking spaces, or you have to fight with the city. It's like that really directly impacts what people can do. Or if you want to expand your business, or in many cities, if you want to even add a new line of products that kicks you into a different land use category, you might have to adjust. You might never even assume, but these rules do exist and they're pretty arbitrary and need to go. And then we also know if people have parking, there's some studies that show this, and it's just pretty logical. If you have parking and you own a car, you're going to probably drive the car more than if you don't. And if you have a lot of parking, you're more likely to have more cars. So the more parking we have, it's sending a message. How are you supposed to get to this place? You're supposed to drive here. And I think that I'm not saying we should get rid of all that parking, but we don't make it easy. It's one of those things that just doesn't make it easy for anyone who might even consider living a different way to do affordably.
Yeah, I think that was a great summary. We'll get into a little more of some of the policy pieces, but I do want to make sure for our listeners, since we are a podcast focused on metropolitan planning organizations, we need to get to that. Are you aware of MPOs that have gotten involved in parking policies in their regions and some good examples of where they've made an impact there?
A little bit. I mean, it's the MPO. Like, I live in Portland. We have actually an elected metropolitan organization, Metro. And they, like here in Portland, for example, they were looking to release guidance around metropolitan area parking mandates at one point. The state of Oregon actually took a step a little faster and moved that. But I know that's the case. I've talked to some folks who work for MPOs. one of our founding board members, Lindsay Bailey from CMAP. And she mentioned that she's used the Puget Sound PSRC materials in the past, or MAPC at Boston's. I have another board member currently who does stuff with MTC in California. So I know that those examples are out there. I also know that as one of the strategies we're seeing as far as statewide parking reform is to focus on requiring metro areas to do these reforms. And I think that there's certainly a lot of role for technical advice and guidance from these organizations to their member jurisdictions.
Yeah, I think that's a good point about the technical piece. A lot of MPO folks like getting into numbers and data and all that fun stuff. And I appreciate you shouting out Lindsay with CMAP. She's the one who connected me with you. I appreciate her doing that. Yeah, and I saw she's on your board. That's very cool. I think those are some great examples you mentioned, and we will definitely add those to the show notes if we can find more details about that so people can check them out. So I think it's probably a small handful of MPOs that have gotten really involved in this, but I think it's fair to say that a good number of MPOs do get involved in like land use issues in general. Certainly, I know of MPOs that play a role in like reviewing comp plans in their region. They review local development plans. They do corridor planning, housing planning, school siting, things like that. And parking is a part of all of those. What are some strategies or some ideas you might recommend in terms of things MPO planners can do as part of that work that will improve the way parking is handled, especially in terms of like walkability and other modes of transportation?
And there's an effort in Dallas right now to reduce or remove their parking mandate significantly. And you look at Dallas and the DFW metro area, right? And Dallas is just a small part of that metro area. And we know that traffic, as I mentioned, to the point of a parking space in one place requires parking other places. If you could be a city with the best interest and the best parking policy, and if all the suburban or surrounding cities near you have high parking requirements, it's going to be very difficult for you to see the benefits of that because the demand is going to be coming in there. I think the regional coordination and the metro coordination and trying to get people to multilaterally make changes is an important one that I think MPOs can do leadership-wise. Convening people, just getting the message in front of them, best practices. I think that there are things around parking management that could be potentially done. I don't know if anyone's doing this, but you know, we have a hodgepodge apps, right? Everyone's got apps for parking in their downtowns, and it's confusing for customers, and there's opportunity for fraud. People put fake QR codes on things. And so if there's a way to encourage more coordination among either vendor selection or interoperability, and even just trying to get people on the same page so that the rules don't just, you drive across an arterial and all of a sudden everything is completely different there. I think that can be confusing and hard. And so I think that regional coordination is really something. And I think that as we see changes in the way the federal government might be operating in transportation in coming years, focusing on things that local municipalities can do that are revenue generating potentially or very low cost and have impacts on multiple goal and issue areas like housing, transportation, climate, public health. There's a political difficulty, but the investment in parking management and parking changes is much lower than a lot of interventions and can lead to impacts and even, like I mentioned, even revenue that you can apply towards some new interventions. Helping make those conversations happen, I think, around this is a great role. We'd love to work with more MPOs on that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point you make about just MPOs can share information. They can convene conversations about these things and help improve sort of the consistency throughout a region of parking policies or parking design or parking mandates, things like that. You talked about the point about parking being more of an opportunity to generate public revenue. I know that's something Donald Shoup talked about. A lot of the parking reforms have focused, as you said, on the parking mandates for commercial and residential development, but not so much about that curb management and making sure that the parking fees are set appropriately and then invested locally. That's a missed opportunity for, I think, a lot of localities that they could, if federal transportation funding becomes more problematic, that pricing the curbside parking is a way for localities to perhaps counter that. Can you talk more about some good examples?
One warning is the purpose of pricing the curb is not to raise the revenue, right? So that's one thing is always you shouldn't be pricing it if it's not worth anything, because if you built too much of it, you're going to have a hard time pricing it. And you should always try to price it such that it provides a value to your residents, right? Or to the people using it. So if you're charging a dollar and it's still congested, why are you charging a dollar? And if you're charging a dollar and it's not congested, once again, I mean, and there no one's parking there, why are you charging a dollar? So the purpose of this is recognize the value and charge. I think some great examples of where we're seeing this are places that are doing, obviously there's SF Park in San Francisco doing performance-based pricing, and Seattle is a great example of a place that has that adjustment, and those are early adopters. On the expenditure side, I think that there's Portland, actually, here where I live, has some programs. They're called transportation wallets in two of our parking districts where they provide a package of transportation subsidies to residents. There's one that's like a golden transportation wallet that's targeted towards people living in affordable housing or low-income residents. And there's a general one that people can get either at a discount, or if they give up their permit, they can get one for free for the first year. So as an incentive to trade their residential permit to, as they try to get the balance of permits and spaces into alignment. So that's a good example. Austin, Texas is rolling out a lot of combined meter and permit areas that are also local revenue share. There are more places that are doing commercial parking benefit districts and revenue sharing where they charge and then a portion of that money comes back and is directed by the community. It's a great opportunity for local democracy and participatory budgeting too, because you have this bucket of money. You don't really want to let, you know, the business association exactly get to control it, but you want to provide the residents with some amount of input, pick from a menu. So Austin is, I think, rolling forward with that. And I think there's a lot of potential around residential areas and using this, particularly in spillover areas or areas they're experiencing a lot of infill potential development. There's examples of PBDs, these parking benefit districts, and these local revenue return. And we are hoping in the next year, at least at PRN, to start tracking those similar to how we track the mandate reforms so that we can have more examples, promote and create some more buzz around that policy.
Well, speaking of things you guys are tracking, you guys have got some really neat tools on your website. There's one that was like parking maps and sort of like mapping downtowns, how much of it is dedicated to parking. So that's something I would really recommend folks check out. I think you've got the 100 largest metros, 100 largest cities mapped. And then you've got maps of different parking policies. And anyone who wants to learn more about this can check out those tools. What was the impetus for creating those tools? What's sort of the story behind those?
I learned pretty early on that cities move in herds. They want comps. They want to know who's doing what. They want to point to someone else. I'll get requests sometimes. It's going, you have a mountain town with 10,000 people that's done all everything. And I'm like, no, I don't know. Like, you know, and even if I told you, even if I had the perfect city, you would be like, that's not us. Like everyone, every city is special. We know.
Yeah, they'll say, tell us about a city, but not Portland. Make sure it's not Portland.
Yeah, part of it is just, here's all these cities that have done these reforms. So when you can see how broadly they've been adopted, and also just you want to celebrate and track that and show that there's momentum. And that came about the parking mandates map, which is going to be some more parking reforms map in the future. Strong Towns, an organization that works on this issue as well, had started a pretty low-tech Google version of that. And one of the first things I wanted to do when I started PRN was get that researched so we actually knew what was going on. And there was like it was more complete. And so we've done that. And that's, like I said, that's a resource people can use to just, we have links to the zoning code in there. We have a super volunteer who, Sam Dietz, who's like mapping out like just entire states. And so you'll see if there's some statistical bias. If you were trying to just don't assume that because a place doesn't have a bunch of reforms that it doesn't have any, it's just, he has, might have not gotten to it yet. But the cities that have done the major reforms, gotten rid of all their mandates, we try to keep. So every now and then there's one that happened and no one even knew, and we add that, but we mostly track those. The parking lots map was a volunteer that came and had this idea to map these parking lots. And that's really interesting because one, it was surprising how much of downtowns were parking. And also realizing that even though downtowns are have a lot of parking, 20-30% kind of on average, if you look at downtown compared to the modern shopping center, like the modern shopping center obviously looks a lot worse. That's 80%. So the downtowns are in a way the best commercial scenario as opposed to what's been built more recently. We worked with folks in Connecticut where they mapped their whole state. We haven't added those into the bigger map because it would be too busy, but we're working with volunteers now who want to make a case for reforms in their communities to be able to like work with us and use that technology for their purposes. And we're just trying to provide resources. These were both somewhat opportunistic, particularly with the parking lot maps. We're very open to sharing this stuff. So we've had researchers take those map files from the parking lots, for example, and use them to do studies on urban heat islands, or trying to train machine learning processes to be able to identify parking lots. We're just trying to put good things out there and see what happens. So most of our data is available. And if folks need help with it, send us an email.
That reminds me, many years ago, I worked for an MPO that where the land use agency we were part of actually wanted, they did a, I think, a citywide map of parking, tried to actually quantify not just the area covered by parking, but the number of parking spots. I don't know if they were able to automate that at all. There was one GIS intern, poor intern, who was dedicated to that project for a whole summer, counting parking spaces. But it was fascinating, just the amount of public space that's occupied by parking. And like you said, even in downtowns, it's not the predominant use, but it's still a ton of space. And still people will go, there's no parking. But part of that's probably pricing. If you get it priced right, then there's going to be parking available.
Yeah. That brings up, do you think that is a point of where something MPOs can do to help is with that data collection or regional understanding, trying to be a clearinghouse for that information or a source of truth, like maybe, or even providing easier ways for cities to collect the data that they feel like they, I think cities often do, they're way too cautious on parking policy. They require a lot of evidence from their staff to fix a problem. I started saying lately, if a pipe breaks in the street, the Water Bureau usually doesn't have to come up with a plan to fix it and bring it to the city council and ask them for permission. They just get to do their job. And it would be great if transportation agencies in cities were allowed to just treat the street a little bit more like a utility and manage it appropriately without having to ask for permission. So I think that, something that could be helpful is maybe even just providing easier access to data collection methods or just more standards, because everyone loves to point to a standard or kind of an official recommendation, and it gives them a little bit of political cover to move forward.
Yeah, I think that is a good role for MPOs to maybe work on some of that data collection, sharing data, stuff like that, so cities can see where they stand in their region. Speaking of data, one of the things I think of when we talk about parking reform is the different parking mandates that exist and the specificity of them and the scientific or pseudoscientific basis for that. For anyone who hasn't read up a parking standards for their city or other places, they really are sort of maddeningly specific. They'll have different requirements for a daycare versus a preschool versus a grade school. And it's like, why are these all different parking standards? It's bizarre. I think people assume that behind that specificity is some sort of science and study. And often that isn't really the case. Is that something, a misunderstanding that you have to address oftentimes?
It's ironic because we live in a time of extreme distrust of government in general. But for some reason, these numbers, these ones came from somewhere, right? This is important.
And so the one scientific thing that's coming out of, yes, exactly.
Right. Nothing is farther from the truth. For certain major land uses, office and residential, I'm not saying the mandates are correct, but they have converged a bit over time towards some, but that's convergence that's happenstance, right? There's a feedback loop where whatever someone built for parking, that often is where the parking mandate came from. They just surveyed local areas, I think, and set some ideas. These are extremely arbitrary. One thing I do all the time, if I come speak in your region, I will do a survey of around 20 cities that are nearby, and I will compare a couple land uses. Bowling alleys is my favorite. Bowling alley is in almost every zoning code, 90% of them, I think. It's weird. I think that's part of why we don't have bowling centers anymore, is because they were defined in zoning code with a specific parking requirement. It's usually ridiculous. So these bowling centers, you do a survey of 20 cities and you'll find a range between 2 per lane spaces required and 7 or 8. Almost every time. And that's in the same region, right? So what really, you show people, even if these were scientific, what could be the difference between a Bowler and Rohnert Park and Yuba City needing 3 times as much parking? And that's the tip of the iceberg. They get crazier from there. Dallas, I mentioned before, I just looked at their zoning code, 220 specific land uses, each with its own parking requirement. Some of them are pretty much the same, and some of them are completely insane. They have a parking requirement for sewage treatment plant that requires 1 space per million gallon of capacity. So if you look at the sewage
parking
treatment plant,
for sewage, I've never seen.
Yeah, and you look at, it's crazy. And then their water treatment plant, it just has a requirement for 2 spaces for the whole facility, right? And this is a city made this up. Who built these? And you look at these two facilities, and a water treatment plant and a sewage treatment plant, And the water treatment plant has about 20 spaces, right? The people building that knew what they needed and they built appropriate parking. The sewage treatment plant literally has, it's a 160 million gallon facility and has about 160 spaces. And paid for that. Like, the public inflicted this wound on themselves. Another thing I'll mention is I find often helicopter parking. So helicopters park, right? They land. And I used to think there were just at least two, and often there will be heliport. Sometimes there's a helistop, and Dallas even has a helicopter base, and they all have a separate parking requirement. And what's the difference? Why do you have three specific parking requirements for helicopters? And so if they're really arbitrary, they're either way too specific or they're nonsensical. And the best practice is honestly just get rid of them. The person and people who are best equipped to make this decision are the people with the skin in the game, who are either the customers or the tenants or the builders or the entrepreneurs. And so if the city is doing its job and managing the curbs, then the spillover, then that sends the appropriate signal and people can make the right decisions. And if a project doesn't build enough parking and it fails, that's okay. Projects fail. Like, sometimes it's okay. If you want to open a coffee shop, another example, the city doesn't require looking at your business model and saying, you don't have enough baristas on at this time, at the peak hour. You leave it up to them and they take some risk and you should provide guidance, but the requirement itself is nonsense. And it doesn't take very long to, I'm working on an hour long Netflix comedy special probably that's just listing stupid parking requirements. Not because they're so bad.
I wouldn't be surprised if Netflix bought that, Tony. Honestly,
I find new ones every time. I mean, I've been doing this for a while and I find new one, like in Wax Museum in Dallas. I mean, come on. What's going
frighteningly
on here?
Specific.
It's clearly
yes.
Wrong. Yeah.
The other thing that struck me, even when I first was in planning school and started learning about parking requirements, it's like they don't take into account at all the context. So like an apartment complex at the urban fringe versus an apartment complex near the urban core, it's obviously one of those is going to have a lot more driving than the other and a lot more parking than the other. And some of the people in that urban core apartment complex aren't going to have cars or only one car per household, and there's just no accounting for that. It's so bizarre.
A lot of cities do have overlay zones. So the way they try to deal with this is recognize that they're wrong. I mean, we actually found many thousands of cities actually exempt parking requirements in some part of their city, right? Like in the downtown core or the old Main Street. And they did that because I think they realized if they didn't do it, it would not exist. And the irony is that those are the places that people think they probably assume need them the most. That's where everyone goes. They must have parking requirements here. No, everyone goes there because it doesn't have parking requirements. And so they'll do these overlay zones though, but it's all based on the junk science. The initial requirement, it's if you're providing a reduction or whatever, you're still keeping this assumption there. And I think even having them there, it still gives a lie to the idea that these are based on something, right? If there was a science behind it, for one, you need to update your zoning code pretty regularly too, because things change, right? I mean, you'll find quite often, banks have large parking requirements often. And then, okay, so ATMs came. A lot of times there's a separate parking requirement for an ATM machine. And then online banking happened. So all of that should get cleared out, but it still exists because anytime you bring forth the motion of the city council to do anything about parking, like, you're in for a bad time probably. So they don't update them. And I think that's also just an indication that it's junk, because if it wasn't, it would change over time by land use or by just social or demographic shifts in the community, right? They're not based on homeownership, a number of vehicles owned, or the amount of population that drives those. If they were based on something like that, maybe you could at least say, hey, they adapt over time. But then again, you're building something that's like permanent. So it's not really even a good way to take a moment in time and decide how much parking should exist, because you should be planning for what you want, not what you have.
So I've got one last question for you. So I'll make sure we bring this back to MPO, since that's our audience. So if there's some listeners who are with MPOs that really haven't gotten into this parking stuff at all, but they're trying to figure out a way to start that discussion with their local governments, they're looking for like an entry point into that. Do you have any thoughts on what's a good place to start this conversation for an MPO that's not gotten involved in this?
I would say folks should get in touch with us. I mean, we exist. We have members and partners of organizations around everywhere. I think we're somehow, we have some affiliation with AMPO as or AMPO or as well. I know our policy director has been, had some communication. We would love to work to provide some information directly. I mean, through this podcast, but even like other resources. So getting in touch with us and looking at, starting at looking at what's on our website. There's some, like State of Oregon, for example, has a number that our Department of Land Use and LCDC, Land Conservation and Development, I think, I can't remember exactly, Evan Manville, who's on our board, they put out a number of materials that I think are really good because Oregon has these statewide rules that are requiring our metro areas to really drastically redo their parking rules. And so looking to states that are ahead of that, Colorado just passed a bill last year that is based on metro areas. And so looking to what those places are often, those states are providing guidance. And I think you can go copy their materials or look at them on messaging or how to park in Oregon. Just, we just had a webinar on parking management that was based on an Oregon guidebook that was put out. So I think there's a lot of materials out there. And one of the things we can do is help connect you to them and connect you to people. So I mean, it's not 15 years ago, right? There's more than, Shoup's book is, you mentioned, get the book. I mean, it's 700 pages. Absolutely get it. You can read the first chapter of Parking in the City, a second book. You don't have to, don't be dissuaded. You don't have to read the whole book to start working on this. There's other more digestible or targeted materials that you can look at.
I think that's a good point. So people hear that they don't have to read all of the high cost of free parking before they start on this. You can expect an influx of contacts from MPOs, Tony, as they hear this podcast.
I hope so.
Yeah. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today. And yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. This is great.
Thank you to everyone for listening. We'll have more episodes coming soon on Amped Up. So please, as they say, rate, review, and subscribe, and we'll talk to you again soon. Take care.